that there's a need for us to collaborate and really provide true solidarity.
Right.
Well, I think the only way that will happen if we put the feet of the Haitian government on the fire, so that we want to know whatever they're negotiating. And then that's what I mean, that they have to step forward mm-hmm. and then mention it to the population. So that if they are doing something that we don't agree to, that we can yell at them. We say, whoa, you guys go to the drawing board
right.
and then we negotiate that. This is not what, we don't want that.
You need transparency,
and then I think
right?
The only way for that to happen, I know it is a difficult situation. A lot of people lost their loved ones in the government that happened to. I know they're probably in a crisis. We have to tell them, shake them up, and say, get out of that crisis, mm-hmm. lead. And then we are watching you.
Exactly.
Thanks for your comments. Before we wrap it up, I just want to quickly give you guys the donation links that you can donate to. So if you're looking for actually relatives and friends in Haiti, you can use this phone number to learn. The phone number is 1-888-407-4747, 1-888-407-4747. For those who are interested in helping right now immediately, just text Haiti, H-A-I-T-I, to 90999, and a donation of $10 will be given automatically to the Red Cross.
Can I add one more?
Yes.
Okay. They can also send their donations to Citizens Bank, all of the Citizens Bank branches, and it's the Haitian American Relief Fund. The account number is 1300112570. 1300112570.
Okay, thank you. And to donate $5 to Wycliffe Jean's Yele Haiti, you can text YELE to 501501 for a $5 donation. There are many other organizations who are donating. You can actually Facebook this organization or this group called Haitian Earthquake Relief, and they have tons of organizations. For example, Mercy Corps, Action Against Hunger, Disaster Emergency Committee, Partners in Health, which is
an
organization based in Boston, and they do a lot of medical care, which is desperately needed in Haiti right now.
Actually, I believe that Tracy Farmer just wrote an op-ed that was in the New York Times recently. Farmer is one of the founders.
Paul Farmer? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Tracy Kidder, I'm sorry.
Tracy Kidder, who wrote the biography for Paul Farmer?
Getting
right.
everybody's names mixed up. All right, well, listen, it is 7 o'clock here in the bowels of Memorial Hall, WMBR's secret offices. And so we're going to have to say thank you to our wonderful telephone guests, and so much thank you for your patience and your important work that you're doing, both to Corinne Désiré and also to Jacques-Antoine Jean. Give us the shout-out for IET Focus. What time can people listen?
Sunday. They can start tuning in at 6 o'clock Wednesday, Compasso FM, from 6 to 8, and then from 8 to 10 in the morning, that's going to be Haiti Focus. And then I will also like to say there is an engineer that just made me proud today, because I realized there's one engineer who just took care of the technical problem that we were having.
Yes,
among
and
the staff.
We have to give him all sorts of love, and not just for Sferio, but for the upcoming show, Music for Human Beings. That is an engineer that makes that thing rule. So, thank you so much, merci en pile, and our thoughts are with you and your friends and loved ones.
Thank you.
All right, ladies.
All right, it's time for us to wrap it up. So before we go, I just want to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on this show are not representing the WMBR Corporation, MIT. It's just all of our own, Sferio. You're more than welcome to visit our website, which is web.mit.edu/hemisphere, and listen to this show and all of our previous shows. So thank you so much for joining here with us today, and I ask you to read more about Haiti and donate if you can. So, all right, we're gonna wrap it up.
yes. Look, we are here. We are here again now. Marhaban, I am Dr. Jalis Sakran, and you are listening to Music for Human. I am Jalis. Jalison here with, firstly, Professor Levine. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me here once again.
Well, Professor, it is seemingly less and less a choice of ours. We find it difficult to be here without you.
Yes, I find this to be one of the recurring problems in my life. I tend to create dependencies upon others, and then I am forced to continue to fulfill this role of dependency to keep those around me happy and sane.
And precisely, there is a sense of expectation in us that is no longer satisfied so easily.
Well, I hope that my presence tonight will at least fulfill the weekly expectation of you, everyone here, and all our listeners.
Indeed, indeed it does. There is expectation fulfillment in your presence. We also have with us voice specialist Aurora. Aurora, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Doctor.
Aurora, I understand that you are a specialist in vocal specialty.
I specialize in therapy of voices.
I've always wondered if this therapy extends to imaginary voices. Like, for example, if one hears voices in one's head, either through some form of psychopathology or mystic vision, and those voices tend to be a little raspy, would one perhaps go through some sort of vocal therapy to improve the timbre? Timbre?
The timbre.
Timbre.
Or the timbre.
The timbre of those voices.
All voices, be they imagined in one's mind or be they expressed through the voice of your neighbor, all of them are real in some sense. And if one is hearing voices that are not necessarily connected to some physicality, it is still a real voice. It is a voice within that person's soul, connected to everyone, and it still needs to undergo some sort of therapy.
So, Aurora, you suggest that the voice is in the ear of the hearer.
Yes. But you must also remember that all things are connected, and the hearer might be picking up some traces, some lost traces of a disembodied soul. Mm-hmm. They might be picking up their own unearthed resonances within their body. Mm. But whatever they're picking up, it's real.
I've had these experiences where I have been sensitive to something for the first time, and I found, to my dismay, that at that moment when the sensitivity was most intense, this was the final moment of sensitivity. So the sensors were screaming as they died.
Well, I have no idea what that means. But on an unrelated note, I've often wondered, for those who hear voices in their head, would they know that the voices are unreal? In other words, does one know that one is insane when one is insane?
Yeah, it all depends on whether or not the insanity organ that is a part of your brain which would detect insanity, if it has been damaged by the insanity. Mm. Then I would think that it's anyone's guess.
So it might depend on the type of the insanity.
And the the amount to which it has taken hold.
Well, of course, we must be accepting of all people, of all levels of sanity, because we know ourselves, we know how strange we are and chaotic, and who's to say that it isn't the insane ones that are running the world, and those with certain afflictions only see what it is for real.
Well, I wonder if any of us have ever felt that we're on the sort of edge of insanity.
I believe all of us are constantly on the edge. Insanity is such a ill-defined rope, perhaps a beach. Beaches change constantly, so perhaps does insanity.
The insanity is like the beach, of course, being the place where the sand meets the water.
Exactly.
A liminal zone.
It's constantly undergoing erosion.
But always, always changing.
Well, of course, these liminal zones are these zones of experience between one category and another. For example, the famous liminal zone between sleeping and being awake.
Mm-hmm. It's liminal.
I'm not familiar with this terminology, this liminalness. But there's something to be said for all manners of things which are illogical, and all manner of things which are constantly changing. For example, a person 50 years ago, or about 1,000 years ago, who'd listen to a disembodied voice, would perhaps stare at a box of plastic, although plastic did not exist at the time, they would be deemed insane. Would they not?
I believe that many of us would be deemed insane if examined by a properly certified technician.
I'm constantly considering myself insane. And yet, very sane at the same time.
Hmm.
I found, much to my surprise earlier, that an imaginary thing could control me. I was walking and I experienced the sensation as though a person were walking just to my left and slightly behind me. Naturally, there is an atavistic response which is to be herded. So I responded by walking slightly faster and towards the right.
Let me say that the only way to be herded, of course, is sometimes to speak louder.
It may be the only way. It made me wonder that a person who was really capable of projecting, you know, an image of themselves not directly inside the other, but directly behind them, would be able to drive a person, similar to how one conventionally controls the direction and speed of a cockroach.
Well, of course, there is a famous fungus in the rainforests that somehow makes its way into the insect, into the ant, and it burrows into the brain of the ant. And what it does is that it somehow affects the brain chemistry of this ant and makes the ant go insane and gives the ant the single sole impulse in life to climb up and up and up and up until it hits the sunlight of the rainforest, so it climbs up to the top and then dies. And then the fungus sprouts from the body of this ant. And it really is this beautiful sight of this kind of ant that has become the soil of a sprouting, beautiful fungus up on the top, on the canopy of the rainforest. And I've often viewed this myself in my own expeditions to the rainforests in various regions of the world, in the Congo. And I've kind of swung along this canopy and found these amazing ant corpses with fungus fur growing out on all sides. And I've often thought to myself, my God, Professor, my God, Professor, this is the world.
Mm.
A God professor is such a beautiful idea as well.
A God professor? Like a professor that is a God, or the idea that God would be a professor?
Well, I think Professor Levine was saying that his God is a professor for being so brilliant to have this fungus shooting from this ant in such a beautiful manner.
Hmm. I wonder if anyone would regard the possibility of God being a student as a realistic one.
Hmm. A student of the eternal truths which God himself or herself cannot change.
I mean, the idea of giving to God a gender, I think, implies that there is something animal-like about God.
I think it implies that there's more than one God, because, of course, sexual reproduction is always split into several genders, implies that there's several beings which must reproduce.
Mm. But would the immortal thing really reproduce? It seems unlikely.
Well, it seems unsustainable, at least. I mean,
well, my view is that one of the forces of evolution is that if you reproduce, then you must die. You must, the organism would be designed to reproduce, ensure the survival of one's progeny, and then to die immediately.
Well, I think if the universe is fixed as some constant, then that makes sense. But if the universe itself is something that can be created by a godlike creature, then I see no reason why God may not reproduce and continue to create more and more space in the universe for the multiplicity of gods as they grow more numerous. And actually, there's this wonderful story from Hindu mythology, and I think it's one of the gods, I think it was Shiva, but it may have been Vishnu, let me just go with Shiva here, is lying on the primordial waters. So this is in one of those liminal zones between destruction and creation. So there's just these primordial waters. He's lying and he falls asleep in a stupor. And as he's sleeping, a lotus begins to grow out of his navel, out of his belly button, and it sprouts into the universe. And then the god Brahma, who's known as the creator god, is wandering along and he sees him and he says, "Who are you, my friend?" And so the Lord Shiva responds, "I am the Eternal One who created all that exists, including you." And then Brahma says, "Oh, that's interesting, but in fact, I am the Eternal One, the creator of all that exists, including you." So to sort of investigate this matter, Brahma enters the mouth of Shiva and goes into his body and actually, in fact, finds the entire universe and all of existence, including himself. And he leaves through his navel.
Mm.
And then Shiva does the same thing to Brahma, and again he finds the entire universe in Brahma's body, including himself.
A completely identical universe?
I suppose, a completely identical universe. And somehow this paradox never quite gets resolved.
But in my mind, if it were so that a multiplicity of, like, reproductive deities would imply a multiplicity also of universes. This image does not, why should the multiple universes be identical?
Well, at least in this mythology, an infinite cycle of creation and destruction.
I suppose if there were alternate versions also of the deities, then it would be... it would make sense that they would all be aware one of the other.
Hmm. Well, this reminds me of the view of a 20th century philosopher known as David Lewis. And Professor Lewis believed that every possibility, so every possible world, by dint of logic, exists in the same sort of reality as our own possible world. And it's merely the case that we inhabit one of these possible worlds, which is merely parallel to every other possible world.
So anything that is envisionable will exist in some universe.
Exactly. And to say that this is the real world merely just means that we are inhabiting this world. Mm-hmm. But to think that just because you're inhabiting it, it has some sort of special ontological status is a form of bigotry or chauvinism towards the other possible worlds.
I see. So this lends validation in one living in a dream world or investing a lot of time in images or in stories because they all exist in some form.
Well, I think we have to strive to imbue our current world, our current existence, with certain dreamlike qualities. I mean, in a certain sense, we have to emulate our dreams and blur the boundaries between dream and reality in order to make our existence more fulfilling and vibrant. This music itself really gives me the feeling of a kind of a dream with a very powerful, funky beat. Most of my dreams do have funky beats.
You actually hear music in the dream? Does life have a soundtrack for you? Are you constantly hearing music?
Not constantly, but maybe about 76% of the time.
For those who are curious, you're listening to Bob Holroyd's A Different Space. And this is track 7, Balance.
I do find that when I go to one of these clubs and I dance for hours on end, then usually for several days afterwards, I'll experience flashbacks to the dancing as if they were a kind of drug in my psyche. I'll just be walking and I'll just feel a burst of a flashback and a memory of the dance, and the beat will pulse through my body days after it. I heard it.
How do you account for this?
I mean, I think dancing and rhythms are just such an integral and basic part of human life.
An atavistic thing.
Yeah, you've been using this word atavistic, and I'm sorry, I didn't bring my dictionary, Dr. Jalas. Maybe you could.
Well, I mean that it is a fundamental, like it's not a higher brain function, it's a lower one, that it is from an earlier version of ourselves. So like, for instance, the thought of climbing being unnatural, I think is wrong. I regard it as, once again, atavistic. It's something that, without thinking, a person should be able to climb, because, once again, we are descended from climbers.
Well, of course, as most people believe, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And, of course, then it makes sense why kids, in their youthful stages, would desire to climb trees, because they are sort of mirroring the early stages of human existence.
I see. So the later person would correspond to a later state of evolution.
Yes.
I'm sorry to say that I have not been following the discussion. I've just been so engrossed in the music.
Well, let's bring some callers in if they would like to be brought in. So, as always, music for humans can only show you the door. We can only tell you the number you must dial. The number is 617-253-8810. And our spiritual operator is waiting.
Yes, I often think, if only I were a parasitic fungus who could inhabit the brains of our listeners and have them call us. I believe I may have just been successful in inhabiting the brain of a caller.
Caller, marhaban.
Hey, fascinating conversation tonight.
Well, thank you for joining us. Caller, do you hear music?
I do. I'm playing some Jay-Z right now. Early Jay-Z.
Jay-Z.
These are two beautiful letters of the alphabet. For those of you who don't know, in the deaf sign language, ASL, those are the two letters that have movement. involved with them.
In the American manual alphabet?
Yes.
Now, is Jay-Z some sort of musical performer?
Yeah, he's really hard.
Is he related to R. Kelly?
Yeah, they're cousins.
So I heard this interview R. Kelly just gave on TV. I guess it's the first interview since his trial. And he was asked if he liked teenage girls, and he said, "How old do you mean by teenage?"
Implying that he liked girls that were of legal age.
Well, then the interviewer seemed kind of shocked, and he said, "Well, I mean girls who are teenagers." And R. Kelly said, "Well, I do have some 19-year-old friends."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Does that count as teenage?
He said,
"Yes, 19 or below would be teenage."
Well, not all the way below. So I'm
right.
Sure he was not implying 4-year-old
or right.
Infants.
Some teenagers are too young to party with R. Kelly.
That does seem to be the case.
You can't fly, you can't be the world's greatest if you're 4. You gotta wait a couple of years.
I believe they assign all sorts of limitations to young children that they perhaps don't actually experience. For example, when I was younger, I enjoyed a great deal of literature. Many of my teachers informed me that I could not possibly understand the intricacies behind To Kill a Mockingbird, for example.
Now, is it To Kill a Mockingbird or Tequila Mockingbird?
That's the Eagle song. To Kill a Mockingbird is a movie by Harper.
A book. It's
Harper Ferry.
So it's not referring to the spiritual drink, tequila.
Delicious, but no.
Actually very terrible drink.
You say that with some
pain, like
Dr. Jollis.
Well, I think that there is a reason that people lick their hands after drinking tequila.
It's because they've been masturbating.
Oh, well, I'm not sure that's the case. I think there is salt on the hands.
Well, it is said that salt tends to go very well with certain drinks. Tequila is known especially to mix well with salt. Salt is really one of those elements, those chemicals, which is, I think the human organism has a love-hate relationship with salt. I mean, I know personally I have a love-hate relationship with salt.
Well, socially also, that as a society we have a love-hate relationship with salt and other chemicals.
Mm.
So there is salt and you know, I have a different, similar feeling also for sourness. Let's bring another voice in with us. Caller, marhaban.
Yeah, I think you're all parasitic fungi.
I think in some way, everyone is a parasitic fungus.
Well, has our caller ever experienced being a parasite before?
I believe she's gone.
Oh, she left.
I think we may have lost the caller.
That's sad. I hope she calls back.
I mean, I think a parasitic fungus, it's like, do you ever feel like, you know, eating a chocolate bar? And take a moment and think about this in another way. Have you ever found yourself standing before the vending machine with a dollar out, not ever having made a conscious decision to purchase a chocolate bar, but suddenly finding yourself placing the chocolate bar in your mouth and without thinking, consuming it? Is there some parasite that is ordering you to consume it?
I believe this kind of effect is a common outcome of certain intoxicants.
It may be. Let's bring another voice, a third voice in with us. Caller, marhaban.
Marhabtain.
Welcome, caller.
Thank you. I was just very curious to understand why the salt always comes first in the salt and pepper relationship. Is it because the salt is an element, but the pepper is only a creation of an organism?
I'm not sure. What hosts?
Well, if you look at the resonances involved in salt and pepper, salt is a crystalline formation, right? Sodium chloride.
Hmm.
Arranged in sort of brick-like, house-like units. And we seem to enjoy those sorts of things you know, more. Mm-hmm. And if you look especially at the separation between the sodium and chlorine elements, that's that frequency that's associated with it, which I don't remember at the moment exactly, but it's one of those pitches which cause us some amount of happiness when we hear it.
Well, I can actually answer this question with some degree of certainty. Salt, of course, is one of these essential elements that, as a human being, we need. It regulates our blood, whereas pepper is a discovery of the 1950s, I believe. Mm. And so it really wasn't even eaten. It was considered disgusting and poisonous until the 50s. I think the human palate started to change and adjust due to changes in the social structure, the kind of decay of the nuclear family and so on.
Well, my view, of course, is that there are several possible answers. The first is what my hosts have proposed, which is that salt, being a more fundamental, simple chemical, produces a greater impact on the taste than pepper, which is more subtle and organic. Hence, when one is flavoring one's food, one begins with salt and concludes with pepper. Another theory is that simply as a rhythmic device in English, salt having one syllable and pepper having two, the sound salt and pepper is more natural than pepper and salt.
Hmm. It does really roll off the tongue and the lips.
Well, I was more under the belief of the theory that the pepper having a spirit would always have to hold the salt in front of it as a shield to protect it from the evils of the world.
And what evils in particular would attack the pepper spirit?
Well, to be fair, we as humanity have been eating the peppers since, I think our theorist has said, since the 1950s. Hmm. That's almost over 50 years of pepper genocide.
Which is over 9,000 peppers.
Well, in pepper years, that would be thousands of years, in fact.
Decades. Yeah, so, in my mind, to be appropriate, to be fair, there should be an entire sequence of flavors. Salt and pepper, why should they stand alone? Next to them also should be sugar, and also MSG, and vinegar.
And clay. I mean, I believe that the elephants in the jungles in the Congo actually have to find these clearings with water in them and use their trunks to dig underneath the water, remove the top layers of silt, and find the clay lurking underneath and eat the clay for its essential vitamins and minerals.
Yeah.
And once again, the clay corresponds to a natural flavor, the bitterness, which corresponds to an entire region of the tongue.
Salt can have very harmful effects on one's vocality. Pepper
certainly
as well, but not as strong.
Well, many eaters will experience sensations of water runningness and pain when they consume certain peppers and certain chemicals that are often associated with peppers.
And yet in the end, the effects are always beneficial. If streams of water are flowing through your body and your body works together to process the pepper and to feel it, and you, I don't know if you've ever done this, but upon eating a very hot pepper, you can feel almost your entire digestive tract
shrivel up and die.
No, you can feel along your esophagus.
It gives you a sensation as though there were nerves that spoke to you in the pepper itself.
If some beautiful women, perhaps, were massaging your esophagus.
Or a very angry man with knives.
Yes, I think often angry men with knives and beautiful women can share the same role. Now, we were speaking before about these parasitic fungi, and I did want to return to the question of the fungus, which I think is one of the most important unsolved mysteries in the scientific world. Most people don't realize this, but the actual largest living organism in the world is a fungus in the state of Wisconsin.
The Wisconsin fungus sauce.
Yes, I think it's about 40 square miles of filaments underneath the soil.
I think that may be the fungus sauce calling now. Caller, welcome.
I think 9X dropped my call before.
We're very sorry about that. Welcome.
Oh, it's fine. I was actually wondering if we could go back to Kelly Furman. I could probably link that to a discussion about mushroom.
About the great fungus. Please do so, caller.
Hello?
Yeah, caller, yes, please.
Okay, well, I was thinking a lot over the past 10 minutes about R. Kelly and peeing on teens. And what I realized is that I pee on teens a lot. And it's not in any sort of an illegal way because I frequent swimming pools pretty often. And when I frequent swimming pools, there are tons of teens in the pool, and often they don't even know that I'm peeing on them when I pee because the pee is such an insidious, secretive, invasive force. So in the same way that I pee on teens, I think mushrooms are taking over the world. That is, they're not doing it directly. They're staying off our faces and out of our mouths. For the most part, mushrooms don't really end up like inside our bodies ever. I think that's how they survive, and that's how we get to pee on each other. Is we don't go about it directly, but it's kind of a roundabout thing.
So caller, if I may summarize, you are saying that the pee is the human fungus.
Yes.
Urine.
For sure.
Well, it's an interesting view. I think I've stated on the air before that urine is, in my view, human tea. And especially this image of you standing in the swimming pool, really, and I may I hazard that it is in the hot sun, so in the warmer months?
I try to do hot tubs too, as much as I can, but there are certainly a lot of hot days that I do that, yeah.
Well, so this is very suggestive of human tea, and then you add this flavoring, this urine, and really changes the composition. And yet it is true that a swimmer may be somewhat startled when they realize that the pool has become cloudy. You know, why is the swimming pool green, they may ask.
And then you just say it's a new type of chlorine, and they say, I've never heard of that, and then you call them racist, and then... Well, that's how I do it.
Yeah, that is certainly a valid approach. But the result, of course, there is that we are standing in one another's urine in public pools. But how
right.
often we consume one another's skin in the form of dust as it lands on food. Or perhaps we are alarmed, you know, we may kiss or stroke another's hair. But God forbid that it should be in my tea or in my yogurt.
Well, I mean, you have to think about it this way. If you're not peeing on people in a swimming pool, how are you going to get to pee on people? So there's a matter of logistics that you have to
get there's
past.
Always war injuries. Of course, the only way to save another human being when they are injured and you do not wish them to deal with infection or blisters or pus. You must pee upon them.
Well, another option, I think, is to live in New York City during the rain. One could simply stand out on a balcony and add one's own fluids to the to the precipitation.
No one would know the better, I suppose.
Certainly not. Yeah.
Well, this reminds me of this story, this report I read about today. And it took place in the 1960s on a Soviet expedition to the Antarctic. And aboard this ship on this expedition was a single doctor who was a surgeon, a brilliant doctor. And he noticed along the way that he was starting to experience the symptoms of an infected appendix. And it was getting worse and worse, and he realized that if he didn't take action soon, he would in fact pass away and die from the infection. So he decided to perform a self-appendectomy. This is a true story. And so he trained some of his colleagues, who weren't doctors, but he trained them to assist him, hold the mirror up, to hand him the instruments as he required them. He scrubbed them in. He made the room as sterile as possible, though at this point he was already very sick. And he actually performed this appendectomy on himself. It took about 2 hours. And he removed his own appendix successfully. I think he actually instructed his assistants that if he passed out, they were to inject him with some sort of medicine which would immediately awaken him so he could continue performing the operation.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a truly amazing story where one can actually...
Well, what did he do? What did he do with the appendix? I'm curious. Did he eat it or did he throw it out?
Well, I think they probably had a decent supply of canned salted pork and biscuits, so they probably didn't need to eat his infected appendix.
I think the standard procedure in those circumstances, I'm not sure about that case in particular, but it's to feed it to a dog.
Hmm. Well, it was infected, I think, so the dog would probably die from it.
No.
Once you cook it, it's fine.
It's perfectly savory and nutritious.
If you get it to like 400 degrees.
Like urine.
Precisely.
It's actually, it's a delicacy in some circles.
Yeah, among dog circles.
Yes.
I forget, does the appendix actually serve any function, or is it one of those vestigial organs?
Well, it is always given as an example of a vestigial organ. But in my mind, it does serve a function. And it's simply that the function is unknown.
Hmm.
Now, as patients, we may be alarmed to think of, any part of the body as having an unknown function. But this is often the case.
Hmm. What other body parts?
Most of our mind
functions?
Is unknown.
Well, the spleen. Also, the function is not clear, and it's not uncommon that patients suffering from mononucleosis will have the spleen removed due to infection with no known side effect.
Well, the spleens actually have a function. They just discovered this last year. They take blood cells or white blood cells up into them, and so they have a last resort collection.
Similar to the colon, but I would think that if the spleen is removed, then the liver would simply assume this function.
And often it does.
Well, some have speculated that the appendix is in fact the sort of interface between the physical being and the spiritual being.
Caller, are you missing any of your internal organs?
Not that I know of. But I have passed out drunk a lot and woken up hurting all over my body, so it's hard to tell sometimes. But I pee regularly. I don't pee myself often, so I think my kidneys are intact. My appendix might have been taken by dogs. You never know. I'd love to take this opportunity to talk about something. I think you guys were a little offended when I mentioned eating appendixes, and I know it's not really a thing that humans do often, but I think there is a certain amount of prejudice surrounding eating urine.
Well, Caller, I would like to say for the record that to the extent possible, to the extent to which we are permitted, that music for humans should serve, I hope, as a judgment-free zone.
Hmm.
I wasn't saying that. I think sometimes you guys are as judgmental as my ex-wife.
That may be, but if that is the case, it is certainly not our intention to be so.
Yes, it is one of the tenets of New Age wisdom that we have to accept, observe, and emulate.
And it is a desire, a great wish of ours to do so. And if any of our callers, or I should say any of our listeners, would like to emulate our caller, they may dial the number 617-253-8810. Do we have a few moments we could bring you in?
I had to put a jellyfish in her mouth to get her to let me pee in it. But I didn't have an explanation for the poop, so didn't work out, between us.
Hmm, that is sad. And how many ex-wives have you had?
Just one. Just just that one, but a lot, several times.
I've heard that some people will...
There's a five-marriage limit to the same person, so...
Yeah, that is an interesting phenomenon where one will divorce and remarry. And I think perhaps my ex-wife is now on the phone.
Yeah, let's bring that voice in. Caller, marhaban.
Yeah, hi.
Welcome.
What's that?
Welcome to the air.
Oh, welcome. Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you, caller.
I listen to your show every once in a while. Usually like on a Saturday night when I'm, or a Friday, I mean a Friday night when I'm driving. I don't know the whole gist of the show yet, but you guys seem like really decent, peaceful people.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Connor.
Thank you very much. We really do appreciate those kind words.
And the thing that confuses me is you got people like calling in with some really off-the-wall kind of stuff, almost like contradictory of what you guys are trying to express.
There are some crazy people out there.
Well, the thing is, caller, that I'd just like to say that the show is not intended to be a soapbox for us to present our ideas. It's simply a way for us to connect with others. So if other people like to bring their views in, we welcome that, and we like to explore ideas together.
That's pretty cool. That is pretty good. You guys seem to have quite an immense amount of patience and tolerance.
Well, thank you. Caller, do you have any ideas or stories from the past week that you'd like to share?
I guess the only thing that comes to mind is probably, does it seem to you that things seem to be speeding up a little bit in the universe? Well, I can't really talk for the whole universe, but as far as like the Boston area, things almost seem like to me like they're speeding up in a way that's almost like uncontrollable. And where do you think that's? Do you think that's like a universal thing as we're encroaching on the 2012, where the planets are going to line up? Where do you think this is coming from?
Well, caller, I'd like to speak. This can have so many different sources, this sensation, but one which many of us, almost all of us, I could say, in this room and connected to us through the air has experienced is simply aging. And while we age, as we grow older and understand more and more of the universe and more of ourselves, we speed up. We travel so much faster through the universe because our net experience, our net gain is constant. And as children, everything around us is new. So it is so slow.
So, Aurora, I think ultimately what you are saying, and this is a common theme, is that it is not the world that has changed. It is the caller.
Well, you're both assuming that the caller is in fact aging.
Which I think is it's true, it is an assumption, but I think the caller will join us in making this one.
There have been a lot of Benjamin Button copycats around, so you can't make that assumption anymore. It's my experience.
Well, in my mind, I've had a similar experience to the caller, and I think part of it is due to my becoming older. But another thing that has happened that is that we have an exponential growth of the number of people in the world, and so you have a result that as many people are alive today as have ever lived, you know, or that have died, I should say, which is an astonishing thing. So it is no surprise that events or knowledge or so on should progress at a greater rate than it has ever done in the past.
Well, I think that another diagnosis of this perception is the fact that our culture is becoming more hurried and more anxious about getting things done fast and quickly. And sometimes it's important to be able to take a step back and say, no, I want to enjoy my breath. I want to enjoy my step. I want to observe the step, observe the breath, and savor it and enjoy it. And I think sometimes we need to put aside some time in the day to meditate in the lotus position in order to really appreciate every second of our life instead of succumbing to this modern ill of speeding through everything and just trying to get things done all the time.
Well, Kala, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm listening. I'm taking it all in. It sounds pretty good, actually.
Do you have any reflections upon these ideas?
I do take time and meditate, and it's actually the only time that I actually am able to slow down.
Of course, there's
the... I gotta say that caller is right, in a way.
There's the slow foods movement, and I would personally love to start the slow walking movement, the slow eating movement, the slow talking movement, the slow thinking movement.
And you should also do something which I've done quite often, is to just go and camp in the forest and live as one of our ancestors lived. It's such a simple and beautiful life, and it's a thrilling life as well.
Seeing butterflies. Just glaze them like caramel. put like a caramel glaze on them.
Well, certain butterflies, I believe, have psychoactive effects, which can also be sort of interesting in slowing
another
things down.
Another way for slowing things.
Yeah.
But I another thing Lunch is that...
butterfly.
That, you know, if one is taking a shower, one is not concerned with the speed with which the water is flowing over one. And I'm concerned that...
I am. Sometimes it's too fast.
That the water is on...
Sometimes it hurts.
Too quickly. But in large part, it's something that we let pass without consideration. And I think that's a healthy thing. I think that it is a problem to count all of the steps, all of the stones, all of the cars, all of the people that pass. Let them pass and do not be concerned. And so I wonder if perhaps the caller is... I would like to warn him to not be overly disturbed.
I think that is a good piece of advice to.
I do that constantly.
You are concerned, over concerned.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I never really noticed that, but yeah, I watch every car that goes by. I watch every person that passes. I don't really know why, but. I grew up in a time where, I mean, I'm 45 now, but I grew up in a time where everybody on the street would say hi to each other. And now I walk through Boston where I work, and, you know, it's hard to even get eye contact. It's almost robotic in a way, and it's
to me, it's kind of a rapist. Do you have a rapist beard? Do you have a big beard?
What?
No, I'm clean shaven.
Uh-huh. Well, I think this is, to some degree, a part of Boston, that people are afraid of each other. They're afraid to be friendly sometimes.
It's so hard to connect with anyone.
Yeah, and I found that in other parts of the country, or outside the country, people are a lot more open towards being friendly towards each other.
Absolutely. Like, I travel to Jamaica a lot, and to pass somebody on the street without acknowledging that you're passing someone is rude. Like, everybody's just, you know, yaman, you know, it's a normal thing.
To acknowledge others. And here, I've had the unsavory experience once of being walking and smiling and just enjoying the air and the atmosphere, and being stopped by someone and being asked, why are you smiling? What are you smiling for?
They're like a succubus. It's like they suck the smile right out of you, though they can. And it's and I know exactly what you're saying, because after I spend a few months out of the country, when I come back in, I'm still glowing and still smiling, but it gets sucked out of me after like a few weeks, because I now seem like the crazy one.
Well, caller, let us all make a pact, everyone in this room, all those who listen to us right now. Let us smile in the streets and greet one another and not feel abashed by our compassion.
And with that, unfortunately, we are we've reached the end of our time, and we must say goodbye for the hour.
Hey, thanks for I'm glad I finally got to connect. Hey, peace to everybody.
Well, thanks for joining with
us,
caller. And thanks also to my wonderful co-hosts, Aurora.
Namaste.
And Professor Levine.
Thank you for having me again.
I am Dr. Janis Sakran here on Music for Human. Music for Human is New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you, here every Friday at 7 p.m. on WMBR 88.1 FM in Cambridge. Stay tuned for Massachusetts Bay and Response. Masalama.
For safety.
Number one.
Cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two.
Look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three.
Cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four.
Cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
This is Brad from Massachusetts Bay in Response. Today we're continuing reading from Italo Calvino's Marco Valdo, or The Seasons in the City. So this week we begin where we left off last week, in winter. Winter.